Hello everyone, it's Tom here. Before we kick off this week's fantastic episode with Claire Fox, I just wanted to remind you all about our latest sponsor, The Monk Debates. Readers of Spiked and listeners to this podcast will know that we believe no question should be off the table. And The Monk Debates are where top thinkers tackle those big, controversial issues of the day. Is populism a force for good? Should we bin political correctness? Will AI take over the world? All of these questions and more have been battled over at Monk events. If you like the sound of all this, then you really don't want to miss the next Monk debate on anti-Zionism. On the 17th of June, commentator Douglas Murray, broadcaster Mehdi Hassan and others will be debating whether anti-Zionism is a form of anti-Semitism. The debate will be taking place physically in downtown Toronto, but don't worry if you can't make it in person. Supporters of the Monk debates can live stream the event for free from anywhere. Becoming a supporter is the best way to make the most of the Monk debates. For just $9.99 Canadian dollars or £5.81 each month, you'll get early access to tickets and priority seating when you can make it to the events in person. Plus, you'll get exclusive access to the whole Monk Debates archive, where you can watch over 15 years worth of lively and reasoned discussion. So if you just can't wait until the next Monk debate, you can always watch Tony Blair and the late Christopher Hitchens debating religion, or Steve Bannon and David Frum duking it out over populism. It really is an amazing resource. For a limited time only, Monk Debates are also offering a 10% discount on their supporter membership scheme for Last Order's listeners. All you've got to do is use the code SPIKED10 at checkout to get that 10% off. To find out more and to get this great deal, just go to monkdebates.com. That's MUNKdebates.com. And don't forget that discount code SPIKED10, SPIKED10. Thanks so much. And now on with the show. Hello, welcome back to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by Chris Snowden from the IEA. How are you doing, Chris?
Not bad. Always a pleasure. Hello, listeners.
And we're delighted to be joined on the show today by Claire Fox, our most frequent returning guest, I think, the kind of honorary third member of this podcast. How are you doing, Claire?
Well, I'm very excited and chuffed that you've said that. So I'm very well, thank you.
It's great to have you, not least because we are in the middle of an election. And as a prominent political figure, it'd be great to get your views on it. I think it's fair to say that it began in quite a deathly, kind of dull fashion, given the fact that the two main parties are led by quite deathly and dull people in the form of Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer. But I suppose the big story this week, Claire, has been Nigel Farage re-entering the fray. He's returned to lead the Reform Party. He's going to run in Clacton. Obviously, you yourself, you're a member of the Brexit Party. You went to the European Parliament. The predecessor to Reform, although a different political animal, I think it's fair to say. What's been your take on Farage re-entering the fray this week?
Well, it'll show you how dull it is that when Farage made his speech, I got a frisson of excitement because I thought something's happening. I think that Nigel Farage is an important political figure, and he's not to everyone's taste, not always to mine. But at least you felt as though someone political was entering and politics was the feature of what he spoke about. I don't agree entirely with his take on immigration, but immigration is a hugely important issue. And he talked about it in a way that was more substantial than we'd heard anyone else talk about it. So that's good. My take on it is that it was a typical story of this election that he made such a mess up when he said he wasn't going to stand, and in some ways showed a certain uncharacteristic contempt for voters by suggesting that the American elections were important, but the UK ones weren't, that he had better things to do almost. I think that the fact that he said, I've changed my mind and I made a mistake, was such a refreshing thing to hear anyone say, that in and of itself is to his credit. I don't know if it's going to entirely change the whole course of the election, but it certainly made it marginally more interesting.
I just think it, at the very least, has reminded the two main parties and the commentariat that there's still an appetite for something a bit different, something a bit more populist. Because I think it is fair to say that he's kind of single-handedly livened things up. But there was this kind of consensus that we'd gone back to normal, as they would see it, that populism was off the agenda. The two main parties were in very technocratic hands again. At the very least, you think it's reminded a lot of people in Westminster that that voters are hungry for something a little bit different, something that addresses the concerns that they feel aren't being addressed by the mainstream.
So if you think about the almost Stalinist and authoritarian way that Both Keir Starmer and indeed the Conservative Central Office are selecting their candidates, imposing centralised candidates on getting rid of anyone with populist instinct or anyone with views which they consider to not be completely centrist. The whole aim of this election was to return things back to the pre-populist era. You know, it's you've got this whole feeling, we want to go back to a normal civility. We want to ensure that the Conservative Party becomes normal again and not the Boris Johnson 2019 populist party. And on the Labour Party side, obviously, they're trying to eradicate all traces of Corbynism, but anything interesting or that makes them the Labour Party. And so, yeah, I'm delighted from that point of view, because it was scary to think that they were seeing this as the final nail in the coffin of populism. And for ordinary voters, that just felt like a slap across the face to me. And so, yeah, anything that livens that up. Just one thing that relates to this podcast, I think the tale of the election for me summed it up beautifully, was that Sunak, when he announced the election, said, and I will leave my legacy of banning cigarettes and the whole, you know, and he misunderstood the whole parliamentary procedure, because actually the bill, which would have flown through because everybody supported it, he hadn't got to the Lords. And even he couldn't overturn constitutional niceties like that. So they had to drop it. And it was like he was boasting of a piece of legislation he couldn't bring in because he didn't understand the system. Mm-hmm. And you just think this whole thing is a farce, right? So that it cheered me up that bill died, even though I know it will find a new life.
Mm-hmm. You were saying just before we went on air, Claire, that you've recently pretty much given up smoking thanks to disposable vapes. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I have never been a vapor. I can't cope with the more intricate vaping machines that you, Chris, and more sophisticated of my colleagues use. And, you know, for health reasons, and absolutely needed to give up cigarettes. So it's very straightforward. And I thought, God, am I going to do it? And I started using disposable vapes. And they've worked. It's worked perfectly for me. Just as I do that, the bloody government and the opposition, nannies one and all, decide that the greatest threat to human health is disposable banana-flavoured vapes or whatever it is. And in all seriousness, it's the most... Talk about a cell phone shows you it's got nothing to do with health, because they're really not interested in the positive way that this has been used by smokers. And I know behind the scenes that major scientists who work in, tobacco reduction are completely pro disposable vapes, recommend their use, but they're frightened to say it because such is the atmosphere around these issues that they will almost face cancellation if they do so. How ludicrous is that? So much for the evidence.
So what are you going to do? Well, because Labour obviously banned disposable vapes, they're even keener on it than the Tories are. So whoever gets in your crystal there, Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
He's going to be banned. What are you going to do? Back to the tabs or black market?
Well, I mean...
Or refillables?
Well, I am going to take the very sensible decision of buying as many disposable Elf bars and crystals as I can online. And I assume that at some stage that will be black market merchandise and I will be stocking up. God knows what's going to happen in the future. But I'm going to fight it in Parliament, and I'm going to do what I can outside of Parliament to say this is a stupid policy.
Can I just say, going back to the original question about the election,
I mean,
Farage did spice things up, but I don't agree that it's been boring. I think it's been quite hilarious. From the moment Sunak stood out in the pissing rain to announce it, soaking his very expensive suit as he went back in.
How that was allowed to happen.
Oh, incredible. I think it's been a banter election throughout. Last week, every night, I'd be waiting for the 10:30 announcement from the Tories to see which insane policy they were going to announce next. Obviously, national service was the highlight. I had a lot of fun telling my 12-year-old daughter that she's going to have to study maths till she's 18 and then she's going to join the army. You should have seen her face, listeners. But there's been several others. And also, flying under the radar a bit, have been the Lib Dems. Have you seen any of their policy announcements? They
usually given from a paddleboard or something.
Yeah, no, they announced at the weekend that they're going to force the Premiership to show 10 free Premiership games on terrestrial TV. It's not really not an earth-shattering policy. It's your first policy of the election, but Yeah, great stuff. And then they said the other day, every school in Britain, I think there's about 40,000 schools in Britain, every school in Britain is going to have a mental health professional permanently working there, like having a GP permanently working at a school. There's, I believe, only 20,000 mental health professionals in this country, so we're going to need to quadruple the number in order to fulfil this pledge, or treble the number, probably, I should say, to fulfil this pledge. So, yeah, I've been enjoying the election to some extent. But yes, definitely Farage as a personality has brought it to life a bit more.
Well, you know, I do want elections to have some politics. I hate to be dull and boring.
What's wrong with 10 free premiership games?
People would die in a ditch for that.
I completely agree with you that there's been amusing highlights.
Yeah.
But as I said, I mean, there's something of the smugness of these parties that think they can come along and eradicate effectively the fact that the electorate demanded they had a say and that there was some kind of political realignment. And they just go, no, we're not having any of that. I do think, seriously, there's the Labour Party have got real problems because they might be about to have a massive majority. And it's been important to see the Conservative Party rightly imploding and people just saying, I've had it with you. And that's why Reform stand a little teeny bit of a chance of getting a few votes, because people are just going to go, you can't say any longer, vote for Reform and get the Labour Party, because it's like, get the Labour Party come what may. So we might as well finish you lot off. But the Labour Party have got some really serious problems, and there's a dark side to it, of course, with the Galloway and the independent supporters of Islamism and the whole Hamas supporting issues that have emerged. Identity politics is going to be a major problem for the Labour Party that, despite their purge of candidates, is not going to be something they can just get rid of. Because they've got absolutely no feel for the red wall. In fact, all of their candidates have been explicitly aimed at Middle England, not their own voters that they lost in 2019 from the red wall because of Brexit.
I'm always struck by the fact that Keir Starmer, who's rightly presented as a man who doesn't really believe in very much, a kind of empty suit who will say anything that will get him through the next 24-hour news cycle. But I have been struck by the fact that it's the identity politics stuff that he struggles to let go of. I mean, he's only recently admitted, literally weeks ago, that only women can have a cervix. That was a big moment for him on national TV. The Race Equality Act, which is one thing that they've been talking about for some time. It's interesting now how even these sort of middle-of-the-road, technocratic, don't-really-believe-anything politicians, Claire, just still feel the need, they at the very least need to kowtow to this identity politics. I don't know what you make of that.
Well, I think that the thing is that's all they've got in terms of principle. I mean, obviously this predates even, you know, recent days, which is, once the Labour Party stopped pretending to represent ordinary working people, they became a kind of rainbow alliance of identity politics some time ago. And that's all their MPs are like that. You've got different interest groups, and they might be being hardline now about some of the more, seriously anti-Semitic elements and so on. And I'm good. I've got no problem with that. But, if you look at all their mainstream female representatives, they are all into being trans allies, right? They will not come out. And then they've cultivated this gay Stonewall supporting trans ally group rather than the Lesbian and Gay Alliance or the kind of people who believe in same-sex attraction. So they've cultivated that. That's what they believe in, right? They're not going to have any money, right? So you can imagine the kind of legislation we're going to get. Hate crime legislation, there'll be more bans against upskirting or the latest derivation, anything and everything like that will be in. So I think they're going to be incredibly liberal around identity politics, and they think it's progressive. They think that's the radical bit of them.
Yeah, right? They can point to that. Even in the absence of anything else transformative, they can claim all of that. Chris, shall we move on to talk about some of the nanny state stories that we've picked
up this
week? Yeah,
because it segues nicely, because that's what the Labour, I think, are going to do a lot of as well.
Because I know that this week specifically you've written about, and we've already touched on it a little bit, the fact that, given the fact that the anti-smoking lobby have had so many wins in recent years, not, up to and including the total prohibition of cigarettes, which is almost certainly going to result.
Quite a big win, that, isn't it?
Regardless of who goes into power. They have got this kind of like St. George in retirement syndrome thing now, where they're having to run around and slave and smaller creatures. So we've been talking about disposable vapes. But even nicotine pouches, which I thought were pretty close to zero harm, more or less. I'm sure you can tell us more. And now in the eyes, not necessarily of the state, there's no laws being talked about, but it's something that's being picked up in the media as a potential issue. Do you want to tell us a bit more about
it? Yeah, so there were a couple of things last week which suggest that I thought this for a while, that we're heading towards a bit of a moral panic about nicotine pouches. I feel exactly the same way about them as I did about 2 or 3 years ago about disposable vapes, where I could just see this coming down the line. And I felt that the government wasn't really doing enough to head it off, which it could have done if it started actually enforcing the law and stopping kids buying disposable vapes from corner shops. Then we may never have had this hysteria. You know, I say hysteria, actually, legitimate bloody concerns about this, right? There's lots of parents and teachers really didn't want their 11-year-old kids vaping. And I can see this going the same way with nicotine pouches, which had kind of flown under the radar in the same way that Elf Bar did for a while. But last week, there was a news story about the number of footballers who used nicotine pouches or used snus. There's a weird kind of subculture amongst footballers. Snus, as long-time listeners will probably know, is a Swedish or Scandinavian tobacco product. You stick the finely cut tobacco into a pouch, stick it under your top lip, you absorb the nicotine in the same way that you would do Nicorette gum. In fact, Nicorette gum was basically inspired by this stuff. It's been banned since 1992 by the EU. It's illegal in Sweden because it's got an exemption, but it's banned everywhere else. But about 5 years ago, some genius decided, and I say that, you know, not sarcastically, someone just worked out you don't need to have tobacco. You just put some nicotine and cellulose. It does the same thing, thus inventing the nicotine pouch, which I use a lot, and I know a lot of people do.
Is this like Nordic Spirit? And that kind of thing?
Yeah. Nordic Spirit, Zin, sort of other brands are available. They're nearly all made by the tobacco industry in this country, but won't necessarily always be made by the tobacco industry. And there is a potential for, and I know people listening to this might go, what are you on about? But there is a potential for less scrupulous people to come into the market, by which I mean the industry actually is doing quite a good job at the moment of self-regulating. So these things can legally be sold to kids, but the industry tells retailers not to do that. It says on the pack, do not sell to, not available to people under 18. There is a kind of self-regulation of nicotine levels. So in theory, you could have a lethal amount of nicotine, I guess, in one of these pouches. Certainly you could have enough to blow your head off, you know. But there's an unofficial cap on that. There's self-regulation of marketing and so on and so forth. But what I could see coming down the line any day now is that somebody just comes in, a bit like the Elf Bar people did, and go, right, balls to the self-regulation. We're just going to make these like as attractive to kids as possible, use lots of child-friendly marketing, have really high strength to nicotine. And before you know it, you'll have the stories in the tabloid press about the kid who collapsed from nicotine overdose, you know, during maths because they had three, dodgy nicotine pouches in their gob. And it's not very often on this podcast that we call for greater regulation by government. But actually, this is an area where had the government regulated when these things first emerged and became relatively popular and said, right, we're going to at least ban them to kids, right? At least ban the sale to kids. Yeah, instead they've been mucking about, kind of over-regulate vapes and have this weird generational ban on tobacco. There's a new product here. You know, sometimes I think there's too many laws made, but sometimes when something new emerges, it's right to bring some laws in to say how we're going to deal with this. The government just hasn't done that. It's not headed this off at the pass. And I wouldn't be at all surprised to see a bit of a panic about this. So we had the story about loads of footballers using this, lots of whom said that, you know, well, actually, they just said we enjoy doing it. And, you know, after the buzz of a football game, we like to use it rather than smoking or drinking, which strikes me as being pretty sensible and harm reduction, nothing to get worried about. And certainly Norwegian, Swedish sportsmen wouldn't think there was anything weird about this. It's actually, you know, if we weren't such a puritanical nation, it's something we would shrug our shoulders at. And there's only one in five footballers using this stuff anyway. But there was that, and then there was a Channel 4 program called Hooked on Nicotine, which was pretty sensationalist. It wasn't over the top, like moral panic stuff, but it was pretty sensationalist and gave voice to a few people who were saying, well, we don't know the effects and it might kill you kind of thing, you know, which I guess is quite sensationalist. But I think this is the start of a new panic. And the point is, the government really could have nipped it in the bud, and it's failed to do so.
What do you think, Claire? Are you partial to a nicotine pouch?
No, well, I might try them now. Mm. So I, my dread is, although maybe I shouldn't be worried, that Wes Streeting listens to Last Order's podcast and that this might be something that, as a new health minister, he will not look to have moderate...
He's a friend of the show.
Not look to have moderate regulation in the sensible way that you described, but that it'll be a moral panic. I thought the story of the footballers was fascinating because it struck me just how sanitized so many professions have become. Because as footballers used to go on the lash after they played a game, either to console themselves for being dramatically hammered or for winning, right? And you'd go out and you might drink too much and you'd smoke a lot and you'd have a good time. And now we're in a situation where they're being so well behaved that they say, in preference to doing anything too socially irresponsible, because we're very conscious of our role model in life, we do something so discreet that nobody even knows we do it, right?
Which is almost zero risk.
That's harmless to us or anyone else. And yet somehow this has turned into a problem. And I think that that, so in a way, that is a kind of typical, as you rightly pointed out, Tom, it's, there is no problem here, but let's create one. Yeah. And as a consequence, I mean, you just think, what are you trying to do? Just stop them? If they're not going to do that to relax, are you suggesting they go out on the lash again, right? Or is it just that you want everyone to be so uptight that no one can ever relax and choose to do anything to kind of, you know, whatever it is that nicotine does, it does something that we like. The other thing is that there's all this idea that you can become addicted to something, right? The problem is they're addicted. Actually, I again talked to some of these kind of medical scientists about the vaping, and they were saying, well, we don't care whether you're addicted to something. We care whether you're addicted to something that might give you, create harm. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with potentially even being dependent on a substance, right? That's not the issue. You might be the kind of person who says, I hate to be, you know, wake up and feel like I want to have a vape or something like that, and that's not suiting you. But, you know, there's all sorts of things that I do regularly and consistently, like, I don't know, going shopping or, you know, all sorts of things that I enjoy doing that I don't need to do in my life that you could turn into an addiction. And then guess what? They call it shopaholics or, you know what I mean? And they've done the same with gambling when they say the problem is that people who gamble or go for a flutter, they must be addicted to it. And this is just actually takes away all our agency, because I think we choose to be dependent on certain things. And I am not anti-smoking. I want this to be very clear. I'm not trying to stop anyone.
No.
But now that I'm not smoking, I was out with someone last night and they said, oh my God, do you want me to go and stand over there? I said, no,
if you're
going to
start coughing performatively.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I said, I've chosen to do this. I've decided to do this. I don't care whether you smoke or not. I'm not like trying to stop you do it. And I'm not so susceptible. That's the thing is, the insult is that if they smoked next to me, that I would get a fit of the vapors and have to have a cigarette and wouldn't be able to control myself. And this, in a way, they say that they're attacking people being addicted to things, but really what they're doing is insulting your capacity to choose what it is you choose to do regularly and become dependent on. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I mean, nicotine's a very good drug. The question is how you deliver it. So the idea that they become markedly obsessed with it, just stamping out in all instances, is very, very strange. But we're fast running out of time, Chris, but I wondered if you could also give us, in a nutshell, what's been going on with Action on Sugar recently, because I saw a headline in The Guardian the other day talking about how the sugar tax has been so successful, the levy on sugary drinks, that we should roll it out to all kinds of other confectionery. And I think after a very little digging, you realise who was behind this. Do you want to tell us a bit more about it?
Experts say that the sugar tax has been so successful, we should roll it out to cakes and biscuits. I mean, it's only a small story in a way, but quite it tells you quite a lot, I think, about what you may consider to be the global blob. This was portrayed as being the WHO saying it, which, in fairness, the WHO is very happy to extend sugar taxes, I'm quite sure. You know. But the experts in question were, to a man, people from a tiny pressure group called Action on Sugar that you could literally fit in a phone box. There's four people work for Action on Sugar. Last year, they got £74 in donations, according to their charitable accounts, from the public. The year before that, they got £7. The person wouldn't even round it up to a tenner. And yeah,
come on, Jamie, you can't be that.
Exactly, Henry Dimbleby. And yet, this incredibly niche organisation can be guaranteed news coverage for a start every time it looks at the Tesco website and says, oh, look at the amount of sugar in this yogurt or in this curry or whatever. And is now also writing things that are presented as being the official view of the WHO. So they wrote this review of the sugar tax. It was published in the WHO bulletin. And then The Guardian picked it up and said, experts believe. Well, yeah, I mean, are they experts? I don't know. This depends on your definition of an expert. Are they activists? Absolutely, right? They work for this weird anti-sugar pressure group that wanted the tax to be extended to cakes and biscuits even before it was applied to blooming soft drinks. I mean, they're nutters. They wanted the government's sugar reformulation target to be increased from 20%, which is impossible, to 50%. And these people are cranks. I'm not saying they, you know, they should be closed down or something, but don't present them as experts. I guess the point I would make is that sometimes when we see things from the WHO, you know, this particular example, it wasn't an official WHO report, but WHO reports are often written by activists as well, probably usually by activists. Very often they're actually anonymous. But when you do find out who wrote them, it's generally some nutters, and very often actually English or British nutters. I mean, we do still have some soft power at the WHO, and so we should do, being the third biggest donor to the thing. But that soft power just means that some, you know, dopey academics from Britain can write some authoritarian reports for the WHO and pass it off as being the, you know, received wisdom of the entire global health community.
Mm. What do you think of this, Claire? It's another kind of example, I guess, of the ridiculousness of that experts say, evidence shows, sort of evidence-based medicine, which is often just activism, as Chris would say.
Well, I am actually getting to the stage where I'm worried about the fact that proper scientific evidence and the capacity to be objective and to look at the evidence is being destroyed, because these are perfect examples of where the evidence shows does not show anything and no such thing. And it means that you can get a kind of skepticism and a cynicism that then leads to fueling other cranks who then won't believe any evidence, if you see what I mean. And that's one danger. The other thing that just struck me when I was reading about this was that every time I open a newspaper I keep hearing that obesity is on the rise. So if the sugar tax was so successful on drinks, what's happened there then? Right. So what happens is that everything is always a problem that needs to be solved. I would like to understand, and I will be listening to your podcast for future episodes, to understand whether obesity really is on the rise. But one thing you can say is it can't be true at the same time that the sugar tax was successful on fizzy drinks and that all these young people who are now not drinking fizzy drinks because of the sugar tax are now becoming obese. Of course, they'd say, yes, but they've taken to eating cakes and biscuits, and that's why we got to ban sugar altogether. But
well, what they did with the sugar tax, firstly, they didn't really judge the success of it on the basis of people getting fatter, which, I mean, kids did get fatter after the sugar tax. There was no doubt about that. And they got a lot fatter during COVID, which admittedly has nothing to do with the sugar tax, but it is after the sugar tax, right? And kids were getting fatter between the sugar tax being introduced and COVID beginning. They kind of ignored that and said, well, let's just look at how much sugar is being consumed from sugary drinks. And after the sugar tax, it is true, less sugar was being consumed from sugary drinks. But it was only ever like 3% of all calorie intake in the first place. If that, maybe, I think 1% or 2%. And then some, you know, researchers who were advocates of the policy in the first place, they looked at the rise in childhood obesity and said, ah, yes, but if you look at our model, you'll see that childhood obesity would have risen more, albeit only amongst one cohort of girls. They couldn't even make it up amongst boys or younger children, but amongst slightly older girls, 10, 11-year-old girls, it would have gone up even more in our model. Therefore, the sugar tax works. It's exactly the same trick, let's call it by its name, that they used with minimum pricing, where alcohol-related deaths went through the roof in Scotland, but they created a model saying, well, it would have really gone up had it not been for minimum pricing. And that shows that we need to increase the minimum price. Same thing with sugar tax. This so-called evaluation from people at Action on Sugar concluded that really all we need to do is extend it more and increase it.
Mm.
So there's no way of winning. There is no way of winning these people. Doesn't matter how much these policies obviously fail, they will never be repealed. They will only be extended. We are doomed, listeners.
Now, I know we're almost out of time, and I know Chris has to go off and meet some sinister lobbyist or something, whatever it is that you get up to. But Claire, since you were last on the show, I think we've introduced this final question for all of our guests, given that we're a very libertarian, very anti-ban podcast. If you did have to have one ban, what would it be? And the only rule really is that it's got to be something quite petty, something that just irks you. You can't ban censorship, or you can't ban world hunger or something. So what if you had one ban, Claire, what would it be?
Ed Davey.
Very popular choice.
Ed Davey, and I was going to say Ed Davey anywhere near water, as we've been going down slides and falling off paddleboards and all the rest of it, except that actually that's been one of the more amusing sides of the election, watching him be so craving attention that he's behaved like a child, right? But on the other hand, I really, really can't stand them, the Lib Dems. They drive me mad.
I think that's a policy that many people can get. Claire, Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.